If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
Hello.
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 Hello. Hello. Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone, on this March 1st, beautiful, in like a lamb, hopefully out like a lamb. March 1st, beautiful day, a lot of flip-flops. I saw them. I saw convertibles. I saw it all. For those of you who plunged in the polar plunge, congratulations. I did that once, and once is enough. We have a great show tonight. At 7:30, we're going to be talking about the new play in town called Your Honor, Jane Byrne, and it's about Jane Byrne's moving into Cabrini Green for 3 weeks back in the 80s. We have the playwright, the actress who plays Jane Byrne, and we have Walter Jacobson, who's going to comment about some of his experiences with Jane Byrne and how he actually lived in Cabrini Green for a couple of days. And that's at 7:30. 8 o'clock, we're going to be taking your legal calls as usual. You can get ready with those calls, 312-981-7200, and I'll try to answer those as best I can. But tonight, we have a special guest in studio. Damon Sharonis just came back from trying the Harvey Weinstein case this week. As you know, a New York jury returned a verdict against movie producer Harvey Weinstein, finding him guilty of two charges, criminal sexual act in the first degree and rape in the third degree. Acquitted him on three charges, the most serious of which is being was the predatory sexual assault. What's next for Weinstein? Did the Me Too movement influence the outcome of the case? And what does this mean for defendants who commit crimes years back? Chicago attorney Damon Sharonis, welcome to the show. Hi, Damon.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Damon and his trial partner, Donna Rotunno, were chosen by Harvey to try the case in New York, which is kind of unusual. And not unusual because Damon is one of the best criminal defense lawyers in the city. He's been my friend for many years. You represented family secrets trial people. You helped out in the trial of Rod Blagojevich and been involved in many, many high-profile cases. Tell us how you got involved with representing Harvey Weinstein, who got tried in New York.
So he initially had hired, obviously he had a lawyer, Ben Braffman in New York, and then Jose Baez. Eventually he found Donna Rotunno, who was a friend of mine from law school, and my office mate. We tried a bunch of cases together, and once he retained her, she brought me on the case to try it with her.
And obviously, and not obviously, but I suppose it's a strategic thing to get a female to defend somebody in a rape case, because it probably helps when it comes to cross-examination. Was that the case?
Yeah, I don't think he made any, you know, hid the fact that he wanted a strong female lead on the case, and Donna certainly fit that bill. But that was what he was looking for, and I think with her, he found, regardless of the outcome, the perfect lawyer to try this case.
I want to talk a little bit about the personal elements of why you did this, but let's talk a little bit about the facts and what's going to happen going forward. The case is set for sentencing March 11th, which is very soon.
Yes.
What will happen on that day, and what do you think is going to happen with the judge?
So the sentencing range, based on the two counts of convictions, are a minimum of 5 and a maximum of 29 years. At the sentencing hearing, I think the two charged victims where there were convictions on are going to give victim impact statements, and we are going to present a lot of mitigation on behalf of Mr. Weinstein. We'll be filing sentencing memorandums, and then the judge has his options as to where he can sentence Mr. Weinstein within those ranges. It's our position, based on his age, his health, the fact that despite what sort of you hear in the public, he's got no criminal history. We would be asking for a sentence certainly at the low end of that guideline range.
Now, you see in some of the other cases where in the sentencing they will bring in other women who were affected by him. Is the judge going to allow that kind of testimony in basically deciding whether or not to, you know, what his sentence is going to be?
So I think from what we know at this point, and you're right, the sentencing is coming up, that the only live testimony is going to be from the two individuals who testified at the trial, the two charged complaining witnesses. Whether or not other individuals are allowed to testify, we don't know. Certainly throughout the course of the trial, one of the problems that we thought we had was the number of other witnesses who were allowed to testify. They were not charged witnesses. They were called Molyneux witnesses. Whether or not the judge wants to take that into consideration, we don't think he should, but if he does, that's something he may look at as well.
And will Harvey Weinstein get a chance to say something to the judge?
You know, in any criminal case, when somebody is sentenced, they have the right to allocution. Mr. Weinstein certainly has the right to say something. You know, obviously, he's got charges that are pending in California, and there is going to be an appeal filed. So the extent to what he does say, if anything, we haven't had time to discuss that yet.
Okay. And where is Weinstein now? Is he, I know that he had some heart problems. Is he in Rikers or is he in a hospital?
He's currently in Bellevue. He's in a hospital ward, but it's a cell ward there. After the trial, he had a lot of legitimate, as opposed to some of the media accounts, medical concerns. He recently had back surgery. He's got diabetes. He had high blood pressure. He had heart palpitations. These were all things that progressively got worse during the course of the trial. And whether your name's Harvey Weinstein or Harvey Jones, if you're 68 years old and you have significant medical issues, the Bureau of Prisons has to ensure that you get taken care of. So they took him there. He's under review there, and we're hoping that he stays there through sentencing.
We're talking to Damon Sharonis about the Harvey Weinstein case. If you have a question or comment, 312-981-7200. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're here with Damon Sharonis, who was one of the attorneys who represented Harvey Weinstein in the trial that went on in Manhattan. Thank you for joining me tonight, Damon. You and I go way back. I represented an unpopular person, to say the least, many years ago. And I have to ask you this question because you're getting it all the time. What made you take on the representation of somebody as unpopular as Harvey Weinstein?
Well, I mean, that's what criminal lawyers do, right? I mean, I think that the difference here was the notoriety and the public notoriety, but that the fact that it was notorious really didn't cross my mind. I think when lawyers start thinking about how it's going to affect them as opposed to just focusing on the case, there's a problem. But it didn't bother me at all. It doesn't bother me when I represent individuals who are charged with serious crimes. That's what I do. And I certainly don't apologize for it.
Okay. And, you know, I think one of the analogies is no one would ever say anything about a doctor. You know, yeah. The guy comes in, he's 90 pounds overweight, he's a smoker, he's not taking care of himself. No doctor judges the person, they treat him.
Sure.
And that's kind of what you do as a lawyer. You take the situation as bad as it is and do what you can, and that's your part of the system.
It is, and then the people who question that, I think it's really more of a reflection on them than it is the lawyer. I mean, if people can't understand that anyone, including individuals like Harvey Weinstein, deserve vigorous advocacy and a defense, you know, they should go back to high school and take a civics class. And it never ceases to amaze me how individuals, you know, will make comments about lawyers, and then when they get in trouble or a family member gets in trouble, they run to us. So the way I look at it is we do our jobs ethically. It's an important job. And especially in a case like Weinstein, where you have all of these outside influences seeking to influence the trial, that's when lawyers, I think, are most important, to try to keep it to the facts and to say, look, you know, whatever you think about him, let's keep it to the facts in the courtroom and not let social media, the media, the public make a decision.
Now, let's talk about the fact. I mean, some of these crimes, or at least one of them, dated back almost 14 years, right?
Yeah. Well, there were allegations in the case that dated back almost 30 years with Annabella Sciorra, 1993 or 1994.
Was it possible for Harvey Weinstein to get a fair trial?
No. I mean, look, you know, throughout jury selection, one of the most amazing things was we had the courtroom filled every day with prospective jurors. And before they knew anything about the facts of the case, they were asked by Judge Burke if you could be fair and impartial. 70%, 60%, sometimes 80% of the veneer raised their hands right away. And some of them made very objectionable comments in front of the other jurors because the fact that it was Harvey Weinstein, they couldn't even listen to it. And then some of the jurors said they could. But I don't know how a juror, a human being, can compartmentalize what they hear in court from what they've heard over the last 2 years. I think it's really asking them a lot. And whether they said they could do it or not, I don't see any way how that did not infect the trial, how it didn't infect their deliberations. Whether they wanted it to or not, I'm not saying that, but they're only human beings. And this was somebody that the media had painted as public enemy number one. I think there was an absolute full court press by the media to help with this conviction based on stories that came out leading up to the trial and throughout it. They weren't sequestered. We asked for them to be sequestered. We asked for individualized sequestered voir dire so these individuals, jurors, wouldn't have to answer in public to the rest of the jurors as to whether they could be fair and impartial. We weren't allowed any of that. So that was one of the big issues we had during jury selection.
And the one issue that I sort of glommed onto was there was a woman who actually served on the jury who was writing a book about predatory males, older males, right? And she was put on the jury. And I was very surprised about that.
Sure, it was. So we were out of peremptory challenges. And then,
and tell our listeners what a peremptory challenge is.
So a peremptory challenge is a challenge that you can make without any reason or without any cause. Lawyers are allowed to strike. In this case, I believe we had 10 peremptory challenges. Maybe it was more. But we were out of peremptory challenges. So what happened was I was allowed to question this juror in an attempt to get her off for cause. And cause, you need to show the judge there's actually a reason to strike this juror. And I asked her questions about the book and whether or not the book was about predatory older men and their relationships with younger women. She said no. We had a copy of the book review. So it was our position that after that question and answer session, we had a valid base for cause. And I think the law certainly supported us, but the judge did not agree. So she stayed on the jury.
Now, not to parse this too much, but, you know, there were some victories here. It's never a victory when you're a criminal defense lawyer and your guy's going to jail.
Sure.
I understand that. And it's hard to deal with that fact. But there were some charges that he was acquitted on.
Yeah, the most serious charges were not guilties.
And tell our listeners what you can glean from the fact that he was acquitted on those charges. What about the case that the prosecution brought was not believed by those jurors necessarily because of those acquittals?
Sure. I think that the anchor for those charges was Annabella Sciorra, and she testified that sometime in 1993 or 1994 in the winter months that Mr. Weinstein appeared at her apartment after a dinner, came in and essentially sexually assaulted her. She was cross-examined by Donna Rotuno, and Rosie Perez, her friend at the time, also testified to sort of corroborate that, and I cross-examined her. And I think the takeaway from that is that the jury just didn't believe beyond a reasonable doubt that Annabella Sciorra's claims were honest. Whether that means they didn't believe them in total, in part, it was too long ago, whatever it is, they returned not guilty verdicts on those counts, and we certainly agreed with those findings.
And so How is Harvey doing after the verdict? I mean, obviously he's in the hospital, he's not doing well, but what was he like to work with and how did he take the verdict?
You know, from the moment we started working on the case, obviously leading up to the trial, it was very stressful. It was a lot of work in a short period of time. When the trial started, he actually acted one of the best behaved clients I've had, especially certainly in a case like this. He was very helpful. He was stunned by the verdict. And I know people who have read about this case and people who have read the books are surprised by that. But the way the case came in, and Mr. Weinstein has professed his innocence since the beginning, he was stunned by it. And actually, we were stunned by it, too, especially the counts of conviction in this case. We fully believed there was more than just reasonable doubt through the cross-examinations and the witnesses we called. So he was definitely devastated by it. You know, he took it in stride, knowing that, you know, certainly there's other battles to fight regarding appellate issues. But he was definitely, taken by surprise and dealt with it like a lot of people deal with guilty verdicts. They realize now that they're going to jail, and that's not easy for anyone to deal with.
You know, some of the testimony that I wasn't in the courtroom, but I heard that some of the victims stayed in contact with Harvey Weinstein, and that there was an expert who testified to say this is common, that sometimes in a rape situation, victims will stay in contact with the perpetrator for all kinds of psychological reasons. To me, that was the best evidence that there was consent, because it defies logic. Again, it defies logic that someone who is raped would go back to the perpetrator and continue to email and text and even see that person. How do you think that kind of testimony went in to the jury? If you were watching them, did they respond to that?
They did respond to it. I mean, and it's not just contact. I mean, one of the things that struck me about this case was the type of contact. Now, Dr. Barbara Ziv did testify. She was an expert, and she did say that individuals who are sexually assaulted can sometimes have contact with their their abusers. But the type of contact that we're talking about in this case was not just one or two emails. There were hundreds of emails between Mr. Weinstein and one of the alleged accusers in this case. And she would brag about relationships with him. She would, talk about getting together with him. She wanted to introduce him to her mother. Every time she lost her phone, she'd give him a new phone number. This looked to us like a very loving relationship. Another alleged victim in this case, would take trips from him after the fact, would reach out to him, would reach out and say, I'm in a private apartment, would reminisce with him about the same summer she claimed she was attacked. So what we tried to do is explain how these types of communications are not consistent with their accounts of what they claim occurred. And what sort of blew my mind in this case, because it was very compelling evidence, is one of the jurors who was recently interviewed said, we weren't going to take into account anything that occurred before or after the allegations, the actual incidents that were described. And to me, what that means is you're not looking at relevant evidence. You're not looking at these types of communications, which really color the allegations themselves. So
interesting. So the jurors, probably speaking for the other jurors, said that none of the things that happened afterward were relevant to them. It's sort of like, you steal something, and you're running down the street. The running down the street part of it is part of the crime. You see that someone is doing something guilty and they act guilty.
Well, especially when you're talking about a relationship. I mean, they both admitted to having consensual sexual relationships with Harvey Weinstein as well. And to compartmentalize that evidence and not look at it is only looking at a very small part of the story. And I don't know if all the jurors thought like that. I think maybe throughout the course of deliberations, they may have come to that conclusion. But to me, the evidence of the consensual nature was really evinced by these emails and these contacts and these subsequent consensual sexual acts between them. So, and you got to remember, what we're talking about here is reasonable doubt. We're talking about whether the government can prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And it is our position, and it remains our position, that these types of communications certainly would raise in the minds of a juror that there's a doubt as to the accuracy or truth of their allegations. They disagreed with us.
Yeah.
But it seemed pretty overwhelming.
Do you think the jury, I mean, it's hard to tell because you haven't sat down and spoken to them, and they'll probably all write a book, so we'll now know at some point.
They said they wouldn't, but
you never know. Do you think that they were disgusted by the whole nature of the thing? Meaning, here was a guy who was married, and here was a guy who's doing all these things, and these young starlets were coming, and they wanted, whatever the situation was. Sure. Were they offended by that? Was that something that was used against Harvey?
They may have been. I think that also what happened in this case is there were a lot of witnesses who were allowed to testify that weren't charged. So you have three or four other witnesses coming into court talking about, what they claim were non-consensual sexual relationships. And certainly after a while, it's a death by a thousand cuts. And we moved to bar those witnesses from testifying. And we thought we handled each one of them separately. But when you put that all together, it's a lot to overcome.
Damon Charonis, thank you so much for joining us. And congratulations for doing a good job and defending your client. As a fellow lawyer, I know you did your best, and it's all you can do.
Always a pleasure, Karen. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Stay tuned. Right. We're going to be talking about the Jane Byrne play that's at the Looking Glass Theater. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. This week, the Looking Glass Theater had its premiere of the play, Her Honor, Jane Byrne. It was about the first female mayor of Chicago, who served in office from 1979 to 1983. The play is set in about 1981, when Jane Byrne announced that she was moving into Cabrini Green, one of the housing projects. And I had the fortune of attending the play on Friday night with my husband and Chicago legendary television and radio journalist, now radio journalist, Walter Jacobson. And in studio to discuss the play are Nikki Brooks, the playwright, and director Christine Mary Dunford, who played Jane Byrne, and of course Walter Jacobson. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you for having us.
What an ambitious production. Nikki, first, why don't you tell us, are you from Chicago?
I'm born and raised.
Okay, so you weren't old enough to live through this. I'm looking at you, and I don't think you were old enough to live through this, right?
I'm a vampire.
You're a vampire. This is your fifth life. What made you decide to write about this really fascinating topic?
I think as a Chicagoan, I've always been fascinated with Chicago political theater. I grew up in a household in which we read three newspapers a day. You know, there was the morning edition and there was right. the star edition.
And it was paper.
And it was actual paper. Can you right. imagine? And the news was constantly on. And this is before the 24-hour news cycle. So I have fresh memories of mayors being sort of these giants in my household. So really, that's where it all came from.
Let's talk about what kind of research you did to kind of put yourself back in that era. I mean, things were different, and this was the first female mayor. And what kind of research did you do, and who did you interview? Were there notes and journals about her time in Cabrini Green?
Absolutely. I started with Jane Byrne's words in her book, My Chicago. I thought that that would be a really great place to start to see what her point of view was. And it was really from that that I branched out with all of the research. I probably researched anywhere, I would say maybe 30 books. And really, you have to be diligent. Though I'm a playwright, I like to think of myself as a bit of an investigative. I think in a former life, I may have had a bit of a investigative journalist in me.
And a historian, too.
And question, I am I do love and appreciate history, and especially Chicago history. So honestly, in creating this project, I really wanted to search the words of the people that wrote their own biographies. And then I also did radio, television, and then, of course, oral history. So there was a lot of research.
Christine, you portray Jane Byrne in the play, and you really looked like her. And I see you now, and you don't really look like her. But in the play, you held yourself like her, and you had the same mannerisms. How did you prepare to play her?
Well, like Nikki, I think the first thing I did was I read her words. So My Chicago was a very important place to launch. And then I read other books, everything I could. I had read American Pharoah, but I reread it. And I read Fighting Jane, the Granger and Granger, and Brass, and talked to everybody I could find who knew her or worked with her. Or knew of her, and I did watch some videos, but I was not focusing on staging Jane. So even though I do look like her a little bit in the play, I think people who knew Jane will not be seeing Jane up there. Hopefully they'll be seeing sort of an essence of Jane that will feel truthful.
I saw something when I was doing some research that this was in Wikipedia. I don't know if it's true, that when she ran against Mayor Bolandic, and his campaign people said we should portray Byrne as a, quote, shrill, charging, vindictive person, and nothing makes a woman look worse. And I don't know if that was true, but wouldn't surprise me that to make a woman look that way would be the most unflattering thing in the world, especially back in the 1980s. You didn't portray her as that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
No, you didn't.
I think that she was, from my research and from conversations with Nikki, I think she was a very strong person, and I think she was a steely person and an impulsive person, and sometimes those things can be interpreted as being shrill. And so I was looking for the strengths in her that I wanted to bring to the play, as well as some of the challenges that she...
Well, and I think sometimes women who do the exact same thing as a man does, they get told that there are something else. I know even in practicing law, I get told, calm down, be calm. Like, I'm being an advocate. A man does it, he's persuasive, I'm shrill. So
exactly. You know. I think we know that song.
Yeah, we know that song. So Walter Jacobson, you told me after the play that you actually moved into Cabrini Green too.
Yes, I did. I followed her there. She moved in with Jay, her husband, and stayed there for, I think, about 3 weeks. And my job as the reporter was to find out what the reaction of the people who lived in Cabrini was to her being there. And there weren't too many of them who knew that she was there living. But she just really did live there. They ordered in, and they went out to eat, and they met people. You know, Jane Byrne, as shrill as she may have been, and she embraced, I think, some of that shrillness, because everybody in her milieu was shrill. I mean, the political milieu, that's part of
right.
politics, to be shrill. But she did have a soft spot, and more importantly than that, to me anyway, she had a humorful spot, and she was fun to play with. And we in the news business did play with her. A lot of my colleagues were not playing but angry at her because she had been successful. And many people who come up in journalism in Chicago idolize that good old Irish political machine, and she just decapitated it. So they were rough on her. And I had to be rough on her, but I managed to develop kind of a friendship with her. I mean, I felt she was honest enough for me to be objective. And I once asked her about that, whether she thought I was objective, because I had to pick on her. That was my role. And she said that she felt I was honest enough for her to be objective. And I felt that she was honest enough for me to be objective in writing about her.
Interesting. Nikki, the playwright of Her Honor, and Christine, who plays Jane Byrne, I want to ask you both, in this play, did Jane get the respect she deserved from the people surrounding her, from the police detail, from the Chicago housing people, and from the residents within Cabrini-Green? Because that was a big part of the play, is how they responded to her. Nikki, when you wrote the play, what do you think? Did they like that she was doing this?
I think in the world of our play, we examine how respect is earned. So dramatically, Jane does not walk into a situation in which everyone respects her. I think that there are the rules in place that you have to follow. When a mayor comes to dinner, you know, you probably have to be very nice, you know, and do those sort of things. But I think in our play, I was interested in building organic relationships. Now, what was actually happening in 1981 in real life, did people respect her as she moved in? I think that it was probably a mixed bag. I think that some people respected that move. I'm sure that there were some residents who were very happy at the presence of Mayor Byrne. And I think that there were probably some, there were definitely residents that may have taken issue with it. And it wasn't as simple as, yay, someone is moving in and all of the problems will be solved. So in real life and in the actual play, we examine the space in between. So you see, it isn't exactly a black and white situation. The play actually examines the gray area.
And there was one scene where one of the residents seemed to be welcoming and accepting of her doing this and appreciative in some way. And then there was another one who was very angry who didn't really like it. And you, Christine, who's portraying Jane Byrne, did you feel the heat when you were up there? Did you feel the heat of the people who were being critical of you?
Oh, yeah, it was very hot. Great hot writing, great hot acting, of course. Yes, yes. It's intense. There's some intense scenes of encounter in the play.
You know, let me interrupt for 1 minute.
Yeah.
It interests me how well these two people have come to know Jane Byrne. You know, there's a lot of years there and a lot of words, millions of words, and a lot of emotions on every issue in Chicago involving the mayor. And you captured her. She was like you acted, and she was like you said. I almost feel like you know more about Jane, or not more, because I was actually there. But you seem to know.
I felt like she was there. She was up on the stage.
Yeah.
From what the little that I, you know, watched back in the day, I thought it was very, very authentic. Even though, Christine, you're saying you weren't trying to do a replica of her, you know, but it. I felt like I was there. I felt like I was in Cabrini-Green. The elevators were there. They smelled like you know what, and you know everything was chaotic, and there were different characters in and out, and I felt like I was part of it.
They didn't know. The audience didn't know. I imagine you two know, but the audience didn't know what got her to where she was when the play began. I mean, she was just an ingenue. She was, in 1960, she met Mayor Daley because she was volunteering for John F. Kennedy in the race for president. You probably know that, too.
Absolutely, right? I do.
So she was involved in politics from way back.
Well, she didn't. Yeah, from 1960
yeah.
on, but not intimately involved. I don't think at that stage in her life that she had ambitions to be the mayor. She knew what was ahead of her. She didn't even think of becoming mayor until she was growing in that job, and Mayor Daley took a liking to her. He called her Janie. Everybody was shocked that he was so understanding of her and willing to help her. You know, he used to say, when asked about his relationship with her, because it was so unusual, he used to say, "The hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world." the world. Uh-huh. Could you imagine Mayor Daley saying something like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just great.
Before we take a break, I want to just ask, Nikki, where can people see this play?
Please come to the Looking Glass Theater Company. We're located right there on Michigan Avenue in a historic water tower pumping station. You can visit lookingglasstheater.org, and you can also call our box office, and we have all of the information online, lookingglasstheater.org. We welcome you to the historic water tower pumping station where you will find our theater.
It's a cool place.
Yes, it is.
It really is. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what would Lori Lightfoot say to Jane Byrne if they had a chat? Wouldn't you love to be in the room? This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're talking about the new play at the Looking Glass Theater called Her Honor, Jane Byrne. Roughly, it's about Jane Byrne's residence in the Cabrini Green housing projects for 3 weeks in 1981. And we have with us the playwright, and Nikki, and we have Christine, who played Jane Byrne, and we have the great Walter Jacobson, who's talking a little bit about the history of the Jane Byrne era. And I'm going to start with Nikki on this issue. One of the things that you see in this play is the interplay between the Chicago political machine, the mafia, and the gangster disciples. Tell our listeners how you were trying to portray those three forces during that time.
I think that there, in Chicago, there is a, you know, you see a lot of pictures of Al Capone and all of these sort of gangsters that lived in the past, and it's sort of glorified in a way. But as a writer and as a native Chicagoan, I really wanted to investigate how the worlds actually come together and they actually collide. The Black Hand, which grew out of the late 1800s when many Italians were migrating here to the States, that organized crime wasn't just an organization of people that were, you know, bootlegging liquor and doing these things. Like, they are all very much intricate in a bureaucratic way. There were members of the mafia that were made men and all sorts of level of the mafia that were judges, that were lawyers, that were law enforcement, that were in city hall. And so for me, it was important that we try to flesh out the three worlds and how they connect. I think we often think of gangbangers as sort of low-level people outside doing bad things, but it was important to me to show that Chicago is a city in which corruption is quite, the roots go in many different directions. And so in our production, you see, for instance, Anthony Spilotro, who was a member of the mafia, and the Chicago mafia controlled everything west of the Mississippi. Everyone, if you look at the movies, you think it's always the East Coast and New York mafia, but the Chicago mafia controlled Vegas, and that was a huge thing. And so you see, it all comes into play with our political scope. You couldn't really operate without dealing with the mafia, and so I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a gang war in which people were fighting over turf, and that it was actually connected in so many ways. And so we have it in our play, and that is not my invention. It's all very much fleshed out. Like, if you look up the history of Councilors Rowe and Pat Marcy and Alderman Fred Rohde, Alderman Burke, all of those people, they are deeply connected to so many worlds of organized crime. So
interesting. And let's talk a little bit about the housing projects themselves, and in particular, Cabrini Green. When you were portraying Jane Byrne, Christine, did you feel that the play showed that she was successful in changing what was going on there? Was there less crime? Were there improvements made? Was that something that you feel she accomplished in your role?
The play suggests that's an open question, how much was actually accomplished. So some things were improved, some things were changed. I think the lives of the residents who lived there were probably, in our play, we don't have a position on that, actually. It stops right before she moves out. But it's a complicated story.
Walter, can you weigh in, just going back to that time? Did that change anything to your knowledge?
Wait, I got to weigh in on something else first.
Okay.
I think there are many people in this town who are listening now, waiting for me to challenge Nikki as a reporter, because Nikki is not giving us evidence of the things she says. She picked it up in books and papers and movies and things that she's seen. And in general, I would say, although I'm not a political scholar by any means, but the one thing about the dailies that doesn't emerge from more from what you were saying than it did or didn't in the play. The play isn't long enough to go that deeply into his personality and stuff, but both the mayor, the first mayor, the father, and Rich, the son, were really basically good family, Irish, Catholic, decent people. The machine was rough, but the corruption in those days, when you're talking about the mafia, was different than what the corruption is in these days, a whole different definition of what corruption is. Corruption now is mistakes in politics, bad judgment in politics. Corruption in those days were exactly what you said. You know, they were bullies beating up on people and killing them. Mayor Daley and his son, Mayor Rich Daley, have been decent people. They never made any money out of their role as mayor. And in fact, the son, who was the second Mayor Daley, was not even the kind of politician that his father was. His father allowed corruption to happen. He didn't pay enough attention to it. He knew he couldn't do much with it. But Rich, the son, eschewed that business. He wasn't interested in politics. He didn't get nearly as involved as his dad. He left the party as a member and just did his job as mayor. I mean, he was no more active in the party. Okay. Now, everybody who's listening to me and don't think I did my job. I hope I did.
You'll get your paycheck tonight, Walter, and you know how much that is.
Yeah.
You know, Mayor Lightfoot is an advocate for The Looking Glass. I think she's a contributor. And has she been to see the play yet?
Not to my knowledge. I don't believe so. We've only had, we're very early in our process. We've just had our fourth performance today. And to my knowledge, Her Honor has not.
Her Honor.
You see what I did there?
Yes, I saw that. But cause she's got to want to go see that.
Well, the invitation is absolutely extended, and hopefully she will come. But to my knowledge, she has not come to see the show yet.
Well, you know, Walter, I think Lori Lightfoot just celebrated her one-year anniversary as mayor, second female, first black female. What parallels do we see between Mayor Lightfoot and Mayor Jane Byrne?
Well, a complicated issue.
I'll ask all of our panelists.
Question. Right? Yeah, if you're talking about personality comparisons, that's kind of easy to talk about. If you talk about how they structured their business, that's more difficult because that's done in such high levels of secrecy. But Jane Byrne did have a sweet, soft, funny side to her. I mean, when she told me one day that when she was in the stands or the crowd when Pope, what was it, John Paul?
John Paul.
Yeah, when John Paul came to Chicago, she described to me that he looked like a pope. He was in all the white robes, et cetera, et cetera. But when he sat down and crossed his legs, she said he was wearing gym shoes and white socks. That's her having a great sense. And she was telling the truth, you know. So I would say that there's the situation, the business, the act, the inside story of politics is so different. What's happening in the world is so different.
Both women have had to deal with the issue of the machine and things being as they were in the past. And Lori Lightfoot, from what I can see, has come in to say, we're not doing it that way anymore. We're just not. And she says it in no uncertain terms. And I think people are really liking that.
You know,
I think it's refreshing to hear a female, to hear anyone say it, but to hear it from a female that we're just not going to operate in the same way. And all these guys who have been in office for so many years, we're not going to do it this way.
Well,
and it's I think,
Karen,
it's a good thing.
There is no machine anymore, or what's left of it
right.
is just in crumbles. So certainly Lori Lightfoot doesn't have the problem that
Fair enough.
Jane Byrne had.
So let's talk just a little bit. We have just a minute or two. You're working on a new play about Mayor Washington.
This is this play, Her Honor Jane Byrne, marks the beginning of a saga of stories on Chicago mayors. So the first play is on Jane Byrne. The next play focuses on Harold Washington. That title is Harold Washington and the City Council Wars. So it focuses in on that part of his lifetime as mayor. The next play goes to Father and Son. That's Richard J. and Richard M. Daley. And then the final play takes a look at Rahm Emanuel. And I think Mayor Lightfoot will also have a big part in that last play. So this is a saga.
I highly recommend that you go see the Looking Glass Theater's production of Her Honor, Jane Byrne. You can go to the website of Looking Glass Theater and get tickets there. Nikki Brooks, the playwright, thank you so much. Christine Mary Dunford, who played Jane Byrne. And, of course, the wonderful Walter Jacobson. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for
having me. All right.
Thank you.
And listen, when you do this again with those mayors, because I had every bit as much to do with them as I did with Daley, I'm going to have to come in here to make sure that Nikki's right.
Open invitation. All right. Take care. You're listening to WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show. When you hear that song, you know you can call me here at 312-981-7200 and give me your legal question. You have a question about something that's going on in your life, something that you have seen in the news that you'd like to have explained. I'll try to do my best to explain it from a legal standpoint. If you have a divorce question, you have a criminal question, traffic, estate planning question. I'm not practicing in all those areas, but I can probably weigh in and at least help you a little bit. 312-981-7200. You'll talk to Ben, my producer. He'll get you to kind of make your story as short as possible. You'll tell me what happened to you and what you need and what you want, and I will try to help you. There's a couple of questions that I have gotten in the text and the emails this past week. I had an emailer. I live in Indiana, and I travel to work every day. Last month, I got a traffic ticket. On the tickets, he wrote me, he assigned my court appearance as the date January 28th, 2019. Does this mistake carry any legal weight? So the question is, and I get this question all the time, if the police officer makes a mistake as to the date that the infraction happened, or spells your name wrong, or has something incorrect on the traffic ticket, does that mean that you win? And the answer is no. It's kind of an urban legend that that is something that would prevent you from being found guilty of that. You could try it. You could say to the judge, no, listen, this was the wrong date. The police officer obviously didn't know what he was doing because it was the wrong date. See if you can have it dismissed. Maybe the judge will like that you've piped up and said that and dismiss it, but probably not from a legal standpoint. Those things can be corrected on their face, and the police officer need only to say to the court, listen, I made a mistake. Let's just change it on its face, and now let's continue to prosecute this guy for the traffic infractions. I have an emailer who emailed me and asked me the question. I'm a small business owner in Arlington Heights. I have 6 employees. What do I have to do on voter day as far as giving my employees a day off? Well, as an employer, you are obligated to give employees 2 hours off to vote unless they can do it before or after their shift. So if someone's shift starts at 9 and the polls open whenever they open, and it's enough time for them to actually vote before they get to work, then that is sufficient for you in your legal obligation. Yes, you must pay them if you're going to give them off 2 hours. And you can also specify what hours they take off. So if they want to take off in the morning at 9 o'clock and you say, no, the job is really busy at 9 o'clock, but I'll let you off at 3 o'clock. So from 3 to 5, you can just go home and vote at that time. The employer can do that, and that's perfectly appropriate. So so that's voter employer 101. I had a question last week from a texter who said that he saw his neighbor has a dog that's chained up all the time, and even in the winter is chained up outside. And he was concerned and wanted to report it, but didn't really want the neighbor to know and didn't really want the neighbor to get in trouble, just wanted the dog to come in from the cold weather. And so he posed the question, what should I do? What are my options? And could this neighbor be punished by prison time or anything like that? The law in Illinois is that animal owners must provide humane treatment for their pets. And that means food and water and sufficient shelter. And that means to protect them from the weather. So having the dog outside tethered during the really cold weather, now we've had a mild winter, but still that might be an issue. And that could be something that this neighbor could be cited for. There are also tethering laws, and they vary from municipality to municipality, but there's all kinds of laws on how long the leash can be or the chain can be and that type of thing. So it could be that this would be a misdemeanor. Usually the police would come out and they would probably cite the person before actually charging them with something, basically saying, just take care of the situation. We don't want to put you in jail for this. We just want you to remedy the situation. So who do you report it to? You can report it to 911. You can call the police department, or you can call animal control in your area. And one of the better things to do, I talked to some people at some of the animal shelters that I know, and they say you can actually call an animal shelter or call anticruelty.org. There's an email, abuse@anticruelty.org, and you can report it, and you can tell the person, you can tell the organization where this is going on and what you've seen, and they'll come out and investigate it and hopefully do something about it. So this can be a misdemeanor. You could spend, be fined for this type of thing. But generally speaking, they're not really concerned about doing that as much as they are just clarifying and rectifying the situation. I'm going to give out my numbers again, and we've got Jack from Madison who has a question. I'm going to get to him and to all of your calls and all of your texts. This is the Karen Conti Show. Call us here at 312-981-7200, or text that same number, 312-981-7200. We are taking your calls here, 312-981-7200. Do you have a legal issue? You want to talk about something that you've seen? You want to talk about Blagojevich? No. You want to talk about Jussie Smollett? Maybe. You want to talk about Harvey Weinstein? Give us a call here, 312-981-7200. Let's go to Jack in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Jack. Welcome to WGN. You have a legal question.
Hi, Ms. Conti. Thank you for this service.
Sure.
I have been going to this certain hospital for over 10 years, and I'm in a health share network, so I'm a cash patient. And the last surgery I had, literally 5 minutes, all prepped for surgery, a guy came in and said, hey, sign this. We no longer give any cash payment discount. And I'm asking, after 10 years, isn't there kind of an implied contract?
I don't understand what happened. You're telling me that the hospital said because you're a cash payment person, you can't get the operation and they sent you home?
No, instead of telling me 3 weeks in advance or the day when I got there checking in, they came to me 5 minutes before they wheeled me up to surgery and said, hey, sign this because no, we no longer accept health care sharing networks.
That's very unusual. I don't know from a legal standpoint what you can do about that, because all of that stuff should have been done obviously well before your surgery was scheduled and well before the 5 minutes before you were going in there. I've never heard of anything like this. Have you addressed it with the administrators?
Actually, I did, and I told them, look, right after the surgery, I had a guy come up, and I said, I am signing this only under duress, and you will note the legal term that I am using there. But, you know, they've just said, no, we quit giving discounts. And I just thought after that many years, there'd be something implied. Obviously, their technique and timing of when they told me is absurd, but I just wanted to know if I might have any legal...
This is such a strange situation. I can't answer the question. My feeling here is, as I say a lot of times, if you listen to my show, that sometimes you have something that happens to you that legally is not right or morally is not right, but it's not worth it to hire a lawyer to pursue it because you're going to pay money to a lawyer and you may not be successful. And what are you going to get in the long run? So this is something that you should address if you feel strongly about it with the hospital in writing. Make a complaint. If you want to make a complaint to the hospital licensing people in the state to say this is what happened to you. And certainly you want to address it with your health care provider to see what actually happened here. So if you need contacts with those organizations, let me know. I'm going to say goodbye and thank you for listening, Jack.
And thank you, ma'am.
Take care. That's very, very unusual because it seems to me one of the first things that happens when you go into a hospital or a doctor's office is as soon as you get your name out, they want that insurance card and they check it out as quickly as they can to make sure that there's insurance coverage and how they are going to get paid, which is obviously very, very important. I have a texter who said, Karen, how do you think Harvey Weinstein is going to fare in Rikers Penitentiary? Well, Rikers is a very bad place. If you look at the ranking of bad prisons in this country, it's number 10. So it's a very bad place, a very dangerous place. It's very violent. There are thousands every year, thousands of assaults from people who are there. My understanding is that it's largely a place where they hold people before they go to trial, much like Cook County, 26th in California. But I'm not quite sure about that. Harvey Weinstein is not going to do well there. My guess is that because of his age, he's 68, and because of his medical issues, which one of the lawyers for Harvey was on the show just earlier, said that he does have very legitimate problems health-wise. And that he's probably going to be put in an area that is going to keep him safe. Because whether you like it or not, prisons have an obligation to keep prisoners safe so that they don't commit suicide, that they don't get attacked. And certainly someone of Harvey Weinstein's notoriety, he could very well not do well in a prison for those reasons. And certainly there's an issue of suicide. We had the Jeff Epstein situation happen, and of course that's something that prisons really have to guard against. So the answer to your question is I don't think he's going to do well. And it's interesting that people think that because he's Harvey Weinstein, he's going to go to a cushy place like the people who commit paper crimes go to. But what he did and what he was accused of and convicted of is a violent crime. It's rape. It's sexual assault. And there's no rich person's sexual assault prison that's different than the one where poor people go. So he's not going to fare well. And my guess is that he's probably not going to. His health is not going to improve there, put it that way. Unhealthy place to be. It's very stressful. Good food is bad. The company is not good, and he's going to be punished for his crimes. I had an email a couple weeks ago, Martin. The question is, do people get bail back whether they win or lose trial? And the answer, generally speaking, is if you pay the bail yourself, you get it back when you go to trial, and it doesn't matter if you win or lose. It's just to guarantee that you show up for court, okay? If you go through a bail bond company, usually you pay 10% of the bond. So if it's $100,000, you pay 10% of that, and they issue a bond so that when you show up to court, the bail bond company keeps your 10% as a fee for guaranteeing your return, and because then you don't have to post the full $100,000. And of course, if you don't show up, they send their people out to find you. And you've seen all the reality shows where the bail bondsmen go out to do those kinds of things. Give us a call here, 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open. I'm happy to answer your legal questions, or text me, 312-981-7200. I have a texter who says, I was divorced 10 years ago and received 10 years of maintenance that was, quote, reviewable. The date is coming up in July. What do I need to do and what do I have to prove in court? Okay, so maintenance, for people who don't know, is what we used to call alimony, which is spousal support. It's separate and apart from child support. It's the support that you get as a spouse who maybe quit her work to maybe raise children or is not earning as much as the primary breadwinner. And if it was a 10-year of maintenance award, that means that you probably were out of the workforce for a while and the judge thought that you needed to have some money to live on until you got back on your feet and maybe took some classes. So if it's reviewable, that means you're going to have to go back to court probably to show that you've tried to become self-sufficient. And so that would mean that did you go to school? Did you take some computer classes? Did you try to become employed? Did you do your best to try to be self-supportive? And if you make those efforts, but you weren't able to do it because perhaps you were older, you didn't have experience, because you're out of the workplace for such a long period of time, the judge could say, well, you get some more support. We're going to give you another several years of support because you tried, but you were unable to become self-supportive. If you haven't made those efforts and the judge believes you've had your opportunity and feels like you didn't make a fair effort, then the judge could terminate your maintenance. Or if you are earning a lot of money and you can support yourself, the judge is going to say, fine, you did what you're supposed to do and you are no longer entitled to maintenance. So that's what happens when you go to court on that. Let's see. Karen, I am a convicted felon, but my conviction has been expunged. Will I be able to vote in the primary on March 17th? Interestingly, thank you for the text. Interestingly, Illinois is one of the states where convicted felons are able to vote. And if you're convicted or you're waiting trial or you're convicted and on appeal, you can vote. And there's even some people who are having prisoners who are actually incarcerated voting. So the fact that you are going to have your conviction expunged, or you had your conviction expunged, you are certainly able to go and vote. And I tell you, go and do that. That's a good thing to do. Everyone should go out and vote. Let's see. What else do I have here?
Hey, Karen,
yes.
I have a follow-up question on that.
Sure.
This works out since we're seeing all the primaries and everybody's starting to think about voting again. A friend of mine asked me if he could still vote if he hasn't voted in the last few elections. And I said, I don't know, but I know the right person to ask.
Well, I don't know everything, but you have to register. So he's mm-hmm. going to have to do that. And he will register and prove where you live. And then you can vote. And they make it very easy. And they should make it easy. Everyone should have the opportunity to vote. And then he will vote in the precinct. I get asked the question quite a bit. I'm downstate during election day. On March 17th, I'm going to be in Springfield. So can I vote down there? No, you have to vote in the precinct where you're registered. You have to show who you are. But I don't know about you, but I have voted every election since I was 18, and no one has ever asked me for ID, ever, once. And supposedly, the law says that they can ask for it, but they can't turn you away if you don't have a valid driver's license or a state ID. So you tell them who you are, and you are allowed to vote. And while we're on voting, I wanted to just say this, and I get asked quite a bit. You know, people say, should I care about the judges? I'm going to just waste my vote. I'll vote for all the Irish people, or I vote for all the, you know, Hispanic people, or all the women. You know, you really should pay attention to the judges, and here's why. Having a bad judge on the bench is very bad. And, you know, sometimes politicians can affect your life. But really, if there's going to be someone on the ballot who's going to affect your life, it might be a judge. It might be your divorce. It might be your son's DUI. It might be a business dispute. It might be a small claim. And you want good judges on that bench. And there are people who run who you don't know anything about. So here's what you do. You go to the Tribune or you go to the Sun-Times and you get the list of judges. And there are organizations that do a full analysis of who the judges are. And that's the Cook County Bar Association, the American Bar Association, the Chicago Bar Association, Illinois Bar. And they interview these judges and they look at their records and they look at their experience and they get witnesses and character references. And they put together assessments as to whether these people are fit to be a judge. And they're highly recommended or they're recommended or not recommended. So you take that, cut it out of the newspaper or print it out from online, and go into the polling booth. You can certainly do that. It's a cheat sheet. And vote, you know, for the people who are good people. And those organizations do a very thorough job. I don't always agree with everything they do, but I think that's a good place to start. And that was really something that is necessary to do, because even I, as a practicing lawyer 34 years, I don't know these judges. I don't know everybody. How would I? I don't know them. And I do the same thing to get that done. Give us a call here, 312-981-7200. I'm answering your legal questions on the Karen Conti Show on WGN. give us a call here. I'm taking your legal questions. It's Karen Conti. I'm a practicing lawyer. And if you have any questions about anything that's bothering you from a legal standpoint, I'm happy to help you and maybe steer you in the right direction. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Last hour, I was referencing a seminar. If anybody is interested in divorce or if you're in the middle of divorce and you want some information about how the process works and what you need to do to get prepared for a divorce, it's a wonderful seminar. You can email me to get some information. It's put out by Private Vista, which is a financial planning company, and I'm going to be speaking on the issue of the legal portion of it. And that is going to be next Saturday in Oak Brook from 9 till 12, and I can give you all the information and the registration and all of that stuff. You can either Google Private Vista and look up the Divorce Symposium, or you can email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com, and you can come out and meet with me and chat about whatever you want. Again, 312-981-7200. Jerry said, smelling marijuana, since marijuana has been legalized, do you think the police will bother to arrest people they see smoking marijuana in public? I'm sure they don't want to do the paperwork, which would be pointless. You know, that's interesting. I don't know what the police are being told. I'm not in on what the police are telling their officers. My guess is this. I don't know about you, but walking down in the loop, even during the morning and during the day, I smell marijuana all the time. I think people are smoking all the time, more than they did when it was still illegal. So, but it is illegal to smoke in public. And my guess is going to be that the police may arrest you or cite you because they want to set the record straight that although we have legalized marijuana, you can't do it in public and you can't just stand on a street corner and blatantly smoke marijuana. So my guess is that you shouldn't do it and you shouldn't test it out. You shouldn't test the boundaries of the Chicago police. Yes, they do have a lot to do and they have other things that are probably more pressing. But they might want to set a precedent, if you will, to make sure that people are going to honor the rules here. I have a text from someone. I'm going to try to parse this down. It says, I have a boyfriend for 15 years. I believe it's a common law marriage. I have one child. What happens when we break up? What happens with child support? Is it different than when you are married? The first thing you should know is there is no such thing as common law marriage in Illinois. So that unless you are married, and that means legally married, register and all that stuff, not just in a church, but you are registered and it's a legal marriage, you are not married. There's no common law marriage. If there's no common law marriage, you don't have a right to go into court and get a divorce. And you can't then ask for spousal support. We were just talking about maintenance, which is spousal support. So you're not entitled to that. No matter how long you've lived together, it doesn't transform the relationship into a marital relationship. So you're going to be out of luck if you're looking for support for you as a spouse. Also, the courts won't divide the property. You'd have to go into another court, you know, a civil court, and ask for a partition, which means the division of a piece of property if you bought one together, which is complicated and is, unfortunately something that might be expensive for you to do. Now, that said, having a child, that is exactly the same way. It's treated exactly the same way as a divorce. When it comes to support, when it comes to parenting time, we don't call it visitation anymore, we call it parenting time, and when it comes to making decisions for the child. So that if you have a child and you have a dispute as to what happens to that child after you part ways, you file what we call a paternity action. And that means you're saying, I have a relationship with this person. We had a child. The child is 7 years old. Now we want to have the court to declare that both parents are the parents and that we want to set a visitation parenting schedule. We want to set forth who's going to be making decisions for the children when it comes to religion, when it comes to medical decisions, education, extracurricular activities, and some of the big decision-making points in being a parent. And then who pays for what? Who pays for health insurance? Who pays for uncovered expenses? Who pays child support? And all of those things get determined. And I would encourage people who are not married or anyone who has a child with somebody to have a parenting plan in place. And this doesn't have to be done in a confrontational way. It doesn't have to be done by fighting. You can actually sit down with a mediator. There's some good free mediators, or sit down with a lawyer who does kind of collaborative law, and to try to reach an agreement regarding your child. And people do reach agreements. We've all, I don't know if you've seen Marriage Story, which was up for an Academy Award. It was a kind of a horrible movie about how people who agree at first on what to do in a divorce and kind of fall apart when the lawyers take over and get people into a confrontational mode, which is really unfortunate. But it doesn't have to be that way. If you're looking out for the best interests of your child, it's not to say that it's easy to make those decisions, but if you keep your eye on the ball and you keep your eye focused on what's best for your child, then hopefully you can do that and get that done. I have a texter from 708 who said, I hired a home inspector when I bought my home a year ago. He missed the fact that 7 of the windows were warped and I had to have them replaced and the whole frame. It cost me a lot of money. But I've been told by a lawyer that you can't really go after the home inspector for any of the liability. Why do we even have home inspectors? So, home inspectors generally have a contract that you sign that has what we call an exculpatory clause, and that usually eliminates or minimizes liability for if the inspector misses something. So I hear what you're saying. I hear a lot of people ask me that question, like, why did I pay for him to do this and he screwed up and now I don't even have any recourse? The whole reason I paid him money to do this is to protect me from exactly what happened. Well, I think that how you should look at it with a home inspector is you should get a really good, experienced home inspector. If he misses some things, maybe what you do is, if it's worth that much money, if it's thousands of dollars, you might go after the seller, because the seller, if the seller didn't disclose something that was material and didn't put it down in the paperwork and didn't disclose that there was a problem or even tried to hide it, then the seller is the person who might be culpable here. The home inspector's exculpatory clause probably would prevent you from doing anything except getting back the few hundred dollars that you paid him or her to do that inspection. And home inspectors generally do a pretty good job. If you've ever bought a house or sold a house, you know that they're pretty thorough. They go through everything. They're trained. Some are better than others, but they do highlight certain things for you that you wouldn't ordinarily know unless you're experienced. So I say get the home inspection, listen to it. But if something goes south, that's not the person that you are going to sue in any event. I had a phone call this week from a nice woman out in the suburbs of Downers Grove, and she said that she brought her dog in to a vet, and the dog was going to be watched for several days, and the dog died. And she was just really distraught about it. And she said, you know, the dog was fine. Something must have happened because the dog really wasn't that sick and the dog should never have died. Can we sue the vet for malpractice? And I know it's the American way to want to sue, but these kinds of cases really are not worth it to bring. And here's why. First of all, you'd have to prove that the vet did something wrong, did something negligent to cause the dog to die. Now, unless you've gotten some sort of autopsy on the dog, or you've had taken the dog's body somewhere else, you know, you're going to have someone give the opinion that there was something specific that the vet did. That's going to be very difficult. Let's just say that we know the vet did something really wrong and that caused the death. The problem is that the damages are minimal. And when I say that, I sound like I'm heartless, because everyone knows we all love our pets. Sometimes we love our pets more than we love our friends. They're part of the family, and it's heartbreaking when they die. But the law views them more in terms of
property as opposed to a person. So there's not a lot of loss of companionship or emotional distress or any of those kinds of damages. You're basically talking about, unless the dog is best in show and is worth thousands of dollars in breeding rights, you're not going to get a lot of money. So if your dog costs $500 and now the dog's 6 years old and died, what is the dog worth? $200. No one is going to take that case. Lawyers aren't going to take that case. And you certainly don't want to pay a lawyer by the hour to sue a veterinarian. So usually these cases are not smart to even think about bringing them. But my heart goes out to people who lose pets. I had Peggy from Stickney called and wanted to know when is the right time to file bankruptcy. And that's a big question, and you should definitely talk to people before you talk to bankruptcy lawyers. Talk to a credit counselor. I have a list of credit counselors if anyone wants to have me send it. Some of them are free. Some of them are very inexpensive. I pulled that together, and these are places you can go all in the city and in the suburbs, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Happy to send that to you. But you want to add up your assets and debts. You want to look at what your expenses and your income is. Are the bill collectors out of control? Do you need to, would this help to foreclose, your house going to be foreclosed on? How much do you have in credit? Is this going to be a problem? Do you have any lawsuits that are pending? Because those might be discharged in bankruptcy. So there's a lot of things you need to know and things you need to do before you file bankruptcy, because it really is the last alternative. Give me a call here at 312-981-7200 or text to that same number. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show. I'm taking your legal questions all the way up to 9 o'clock, I think, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We have a texter who says, really good question. When you become a lawyer, are you able to practice all aspects of law, or do you have to declare a certain type of practice? Very good question. And the scary answer is that when you become a lawyer, you can hang out a shingle the next day, that you've passed the bar exam and you get sworn in, and you can practice any type of law you want. You can try criminal cases. You can try all kinds of criminal matters. You can sue for breach of contract, divorces. It doesn't matter. So that's why it's so important to make sure that the lawyer that you choose is experienced in the area. And the only way to do that is to really research that person. You want to know how many years out of law school he is or she is. You want to know what percentage of their practice is in the area at issue. So, you know, if you need a divorce, you don't want someone who's just a bankruptcy lawyer and occasionally does a family law case. The only area of law where you need to have a certain type of designation, and that is like the patent bar. And to be a patent lawyer, you need to be have a degree in engineering, and you need to take a special test that's very difficult, and then you get certified in that area. But that is the only area where you have to have some sort of certification. And I don't know how serious people have talked about it, but I've heard lawyers talk about whether or not there should be some sort of specialty, like should there be a major in law school if you want to practice in a certain area, whether it's consumer issues or if you want to do criminal defense, that you get a specialty in that. We can't even say, actually, that we have a specialty. That is against our code of ethics. We have to say we concentrate our practice in criminal law, because in many jurisdictions, in many cities that are smaller downstate, you have lawyers who represent people in all different things. People will be, you know, they'll do a murder case, they'll do traffic, they'll do divorce, they'll write your will because they have to, because the towns are so small that they have to do all of those things in the jurisdiction. Some of them maybe even take turns being the state's attorney in the county. So, but in Chicago, we're lucky to have a very good bar, and people who go to law school usually come out and practice in Chicago in a firm first, and they start there and they get training, which is good, and they get experience, which is good. And we are more concentrating on our practices. I mean, most lawyers who I know have an area. They don't do five different types of law. It's not the way it works, because people do expect you to have some really good level of experience in your area. So thank you for that question. It's a very, very good one. I had an email, or I'm going to change the facts a little bit on this one. She calls to say that her son worked in a restaurant, and it's a small company, and he likes his job, but one of the owners is trying to kind of proselytize to him and pulls out the Bible and tries to convert him to the religion that she is, and he's a Catholic, and he doesn't want to be converted. So what should he do? Well, interestingly, this is a situation where, you know, it's your First Amendment right not to be bothered in the workplace, and the laws are pretty clear that you can't do this type of thing. And this is just more of a practical answer than it is a legal answer, but, you know, this person is well-meaning, according to the email, and doesn't mean to harm the employee, but may just not know that it's inappropriate. So maybe what you do is you say, listen, I really appreciate that you're doing this. I know that you're heartfelt, your heart's in the right place here, but I'm just not comfortable, and I understand that, you know, this is not appropriate in the workplace, and I would just really, really appreciate if you didn't do that and smile and try to make sure that person is not offended by what you're saying, because what she is doing is arguably against the law. Now, this is small employee, number of employees, so is there technically a violation of the Human Rights Act, which is the Illinois statute, or the EEOC as an EEOC action? It's a small company. But probably if that went to a lawsuit, it probably would be a violation of the Human Rights Act in Illinois. So again, but when you like your job and you have a job and you want to keep a job, what I tell people to do is to try to inform the employer in a nice way. Not, hey, I talked to a lawyer, I lawyered up, and you're violating the law, and if you don't do this, I'm going to sue you. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a very nice way of doing it. And you might even want to do it in writing so that you have it there, and you have it, the person can actually maybe even cite to the law you're talking about and just say nicely, you know, I'm sure this is going to end and no hard feelings. So hopefully that will work. So I got another texter. We're talking about animal stuff. And she said, my sister is getting divorced and she has two dogs. And they are fighting. My sister and her husband are fighting over who gets the dogs. And I want to know what your take is on what her chances are of getting the dogs. She wants both of them. They both want both of them. That's a good question. Both, there is a new law, a relatively new law in Illinois in the last couple of years that changes the way judges view pets in a divorce. Pets normally were kind of like property, as I said, they were in a pet malpractice lawsuit. But now judges are allowed to consider things like what is in the dog's best interest? Who does the dog really like? Who feeds the dog? Who walks the dog? Is there a suitable place for the dog to live? So let's just say that your sister is living out in the country and her husband is living in a small apartment in the city and they have two Great Danes. I'm making that up. So where would they go? Well, you know, you don't want to have two Great Danes in an apartment in the city. The judge can look at where the dogs are best situated. And, you know, the other thing is if there was a gift, if husband gave wife the dogs as gifts for her birthday, it's deemed to be a gift and the wife would get the dogs. If, let's just say the husband was the one who always went out walking with the dog and running with the dogs and brought the dogs to the vet and took care of the grooming of the dog, well, then the judge could consider that and say the dogs are better off going with the husband. And I always talk about this case. It was really an interesting case where there was a beloved dog in a divorce situation and the dog would follow the children. So if the children went to visit mom, the dog would go to mom. And then when they would go back to dad, the dog would go with the kids to dad. So when there were these drop-offs and pickups, which we all see in divorced families, this dog was just part of the whole drop-off and pickup. So, and it worked for them. And they shared the expenses, and they had in their divorce decree that they would share veterinary expenses and shots and things like that. And kind of an interesting thing, and in a divorce, almost you can you can agree to almost anything. Let's see, 312-981-7200. I am buying a house. If I make an offer, does that bind me to actually buying the house? I think I understand that. So let's say you're looking at a house and you say, all right, the listing price is $250 and I'm going to put an offer down of $240. If I put that offer down, am I then bound by that offer when and if it's accepted by the seller? And the answer is yes and no. Yes, you are technically bound because now you have entered into a contract, and then you will be filling out the real estate, residential real estate contract, and it's a kind of a form, and it will have all kinds of provisions in there that will allow you to get out of it if you really want to tell you the truth. It's the only contract that I know of that it binds you, but then it doesn't bind you. So what I'm saying is this. In that contract, it will say you have a certain number of days to get a lawyer to look at different contingencies in the contract and to try to negotiate different provisions. So we're going to negotiate tax issues. We're going to negotiate move-in times. We're going to negotiate a language and wording. So so that's one way. And if your lawyer comes in there and starts demanding different things be in the contract and you don't, and the other side doesn't agree, then you can get out of that contract. Or financing. It could be contingent on you getting financing from a mortgage company. And if you don't get financing, then you don't buy the house. And then there are inspection provisions where you can have somebody come in and do an inspection. And if certain things are missing or you think things aren't need to be fixed and you can't come to terms on who's going to do the fixing or give the credits for those types of things, then the contract can fail and you have to start all over again. So the answer is yes, when you put an offer down and it's accepted, you're bound, but there are ways to get out of it. And I highly recommend that everybody get a real estate lawyer. They asked me that question. For a few hundred dollars, you're making the biggest purchase of your life. You need a very experienced real estate attorney to represent you in all of these things. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Hey, you know what? I'm going to do my Karen Conti quiz, and I'm going to pull in my husband, Jerry. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, sweetheart.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I get to call you sweetheart, you know, because we're married.
That's, you call everyone sweetheart.
That's true.
Okay, here we go. Ready? Are you feeling lucky?
No.
Okay, here we go. Governor J.B. Pritzker has gotten 130 gifts since taking office. He has to disclose them, and he did this week. What one of these gifts did he not receive? One of them is fake. A, a $950 bottle of Japanese whiskey. B, a bust of Abraham Lincoln. C, a CD of the movie Bodyguard. Or D, a do-it-yourself manual on how to maintain your toilet.
I'm going to go with a bust of Abraham Lincoln.
I am so sorry. It is a do-it-yourself manual on how to maintain your toilet. I made that up.
Oh, did you really?
I totally made that
up. I thought I read that book.
Yeah. Justin Timberlake sparked a Girl Scout cookie debate this week when he, A, performed an a cappella song that he wrote called I Was Meant for You, B, declared on social media that Samoas were his favorite Girl Scout cookie, C, he announced the Girl Scouts were, quote, out of sync for not having more gluten-free options, or D, told Ellen DeGeneres that his wife, Jessica Biel, sold more Girl Scout cookies than anyone else in the country when she was 10 years old.
Well, I'm sure all those people out in Hollywood are concerned about being gluten-free, so I'll go with that.
Oh, Jerry, you're not doing too well.
What can I tell you?
He declared on social media that Samoas were his favorite Girl Scout cookies over Thin Mints because he loves coconut. That's all we have time for, Jerry.
Where do you get these questions?
That's all we have time for. Anyway, thank you for playing, and thank you for listening. If you want to reach me, I am at WGN at AskKarenConti.com or 312-332-7800. And thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.